is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast, Neue Musik Leben. I have studied classical singing, but I'm singing a lot of contemporary music. And if you would like to meet me or hear me sing, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I also put my website in the show notes. This is a German podcast, but once in a while I do some interviews in English. This podcast is all around new and contemporary and experimental music. I share with you the backgrounds behind the scenes, and I want to bring the humans out of the new music world closer to you. I'm always very thankful for your feedbacks, and I love getting your emails or through Facebook or however you contact me. I'm also proud that I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, which is a big German music paper. Today I have a great interview for you with the composer Tom Johnson. Hello, I'm sitting here in Cologne with the wonderful composer Tom Johnson. I'm so privileged and happy to see you here.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, and I'm feeling very good because the concert last night was so fine and there were so many old friends. I haven't been in Cologne for quite a few years, but I've been over the years in Cologne several times. I did some Hörspiele for Klaus Schoening, WDR, and then Gisela Gronemeyer and Ölschlegel organized the oratorio for Deutschlandradio, Bonner for oratorio, and many others. I guess for the Hochschule for Musik once or twice, and different things in
I know,
Cologne.
You have a very close connection to Cologne.
Yeah, and so a lot of people like Peter Berenson, who I had worked with at the radio, who I hadn't seen for 20 years, and he showed up at the concert.
Yes, it was a wonderful concert. I was there too. So let's get into my questions.
Yes.
I would like to know, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Poof. Well, you have to read the new music text, the book.
Okay, we'll talk about that too.
Yeah, I got up to page 62 today, which is the interview I did with the Yale Oral Archives in the late 90s. And that covers all the early years. And it's many different phases and things that I'm supposed to repeat to really answer your question, but that's already 62 pages, and we don't have time.
I think. Do you know
people
about,
should
like,
read the book if they want to know all that.
I know they will read the book, but like your first approach or anything that was very early and unique.
I often say that my logical music begins with counting music, and of course, and in different languages. Oh yeah, I didn't do it last night. I was thinking if they asked me that I was going to give the example 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 1, 6, 1, 7, 1, 2, 1, 1, 2, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 4, 1, 2, 5, 1, 2, 6, 1, 2, 7. 1, 2, 3, 1, 1, 2, 3, 2, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 6, 1, 2, 3, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7. I made a mistake.
That's a better performance by you.
No, but if I'm concentrating, and I can do these in performance, often in sound poetry festivals or performance festivals, and sometimes in concerts. And that was the beginning. I gradually learned how to count to 7 in a musical way in 12 different languages. And this became a 30-minute recital that I could do.
And when did you start that?
Well, that starts in the late 70s. I don't know exactly. I like to tell the story about one day when I was on the Coney Island on the beach. It was a hot summer day and I was all alone. And I started counting. I'd written about Charlie Morrow, who was also doing counting, wanting to make music out of counting. And so I started it, but I decided to, instead of counting in English, I would count in French. And, I won't do it now, because I've recorded this quite a few times.
Yes.
And then I thought, what other languages do I know? Well, I'd been to Russia with the Yale Russian course, so I could count to 7 in Russian. And I knew some German already. I had had one course in German and Spanish. And then I thought, each language has another rhythm.
Music?
It's another sound. It's so beautiful. Yeah. I think I can make music out of these languages. Then I wanted to start learning. Every time I had met somebody who came from another language I didn't know, I wanted to learn languages from native speakers, and I always did, to try to get the pronunciation right. And so I finally had these, had 12 languages that I had pieces that I liked. And this was sort of the beginning, I think. But then,
so you were first interested in counting, and then you added the sounds?
That was one category anyway. But about the same time as 1979, had gotten these 9 bells hanging on the ceiling. And this is a geometric formation, 3x3. And I started walking around this 3x3 square and hitting the bells as I came to them, and then hanging the bells in a different order, and making the pathway in a different formation, and then doing a figure eight, and then doing a circle all around, or the inside circle, or just something with the middle bell and the side bells, or whatever. So that was geometric logic. And then about the same time I was writing Symmetries, which was geometric logic with notes on paper written within a musical typewriter, where you didn't have the staves, you just had notes. So you could make the notes in any diagonal formation, as long and as high and as low as you wanted, and all this. So that became Symmetries. And so there were several different kinds of logical formations that were starting around this time.
Were you also good in mathematics?
No. Well, I mean, I guess I wasn't so bad, but they told me when I was a teenager, but you're a musician, you don't need to study mathematics. That's just for the engineers.
Wow.
And very bad advice.
That's a bad advice. I made the discovery that there are musicians who are really bad at math, and there are musicians who are really amazing at math.
I suppose, yeah.
Music is somewhat math. You know that better than me.
But it's, not necessarily. A lot of musicians are bad at math. And I can't say I'm good at math. But I just didn't do it when I was young enough to really learn mathematics. At the age of 40 or so, I said, gee, it's too bad that I didn't study math. So I took a course finally in differential calculus, and I was in this course in a very low level night course in a university in upstate New York, and I studied. I finally passed the exam, but all these 19, 20 year old students who were in the course didn't study at all, and they were getting A's with no problem. It's just the youth of the mind that absorbs these things much more quickly. So I decided, after that experience, if I can't even do differential calculus, it's going to be very late to start.
But that's very difficult.
Algebraic geometry and everything else.
What represents good new music for you?
Well, I think the important thing is that the composer has found his own music, some kind of, not necessarily original in some dramatic sense, but just something that's honest. It wasn't the music of somebody else, and it's not being a copy of something. and not certainly not the copy of the teacher or somebody has gotten into their own music. That's what's important for me anyway.
And what are the qualities you most appreciate in performers you work with?
In the performers?
Yes.
Well, basically, and this may seem obvious, but it's not so obvious and it's rather rare. Get the notes right. Really a perfection of the, not change the tempo. Get in time and in tune. That's a way to simplify.
Okay.
A good musician is somebody who plays in time, in tune. And but the get the right notes and the right tempo is very important for my music and any sort of objective mathematical music. It has to be right. And you can identify a wrong note immediately. Of course, when music becomes very subjective and it's all expressionistic and so complex, there's so many levels of logic and illogic at the same time, you can't tell whether these notes are right or wrong. And then it doesn't, this precision isn't so important. But with my music, you got to get it right.
And how do your friends, family, colleagues, and audience react to your sort of music? And how do you deal with their reactions?
Well, most of my friends these days are colleagues and people who know me and who like my music, or we wouldn't be friends. Of course, my family comes from other places and they don't understand very much. And we don't even talk about music. The neighbors and the family, that's just people I know from, and the people I know in the American church in Paris, I have very good friends in there, but we talk about life and death and God. We don't talk about music.
I also like that you have a certain humor in your music. And
yeah.
Last night you even told the audience that you were sometimes looking around how they react, or if they were laughing or enjoying it.
Well, I talk too much about that, and because I wanted people to feel at ease if they needed to smile, to smile.
It worked.
But
were more at ease.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, and then at the end they were more at ease. But I should have said, as I just read this morning in the book, something I said many years ago. I like humor. But I made a rule a long time ago, never try to be funny.
That's good.
Because every time you try to be funny, it's you're telling jokes and it's stupid. And then the example I give in the book, which is a very good example, is the aria in the Four Note Opera where the baritone says, "In a moment you will hear the woodblock. It's a tiny event, but I hope you do not miss it. Because it's a nice sound and I hope you do not miss it. Listen carefully, because in a moment you will hear, I hope you do not miss it. I hope you do not miss it. I hope you do not miss it. I hope you did not miss it. I hope you did not miss it." You laughed. Why does everybody laugh when finally the woodblock came? But this is just telling a situation, an absurd situation. It's not trying to be funny. It's just telling a little story.
I know. You said it yourself. It's an art than to be actually funny.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the kind of humor that I try to do.
You're very good at it.
I mean, that I try not to do.
And
I said you can't try to be funny.
Yes. But I like it so much because I think, especially in the contemporary music, we are so serious, and I always like it if there's something else.
But it's not the humor that's humorous, it's the logic that's humorous.
Mm-hmm.
And then the good example of that in the concert last night is the place where the clarinet plays the descending scales longer and longer and longer. And the other two instruments play only the first note. And then he finally gets down to the bottom of the scale. And then the other two instruments only play the last note. And then he goes until finally he's only playing the last note with them. And then he starts going back up, and they're still playing the bottom note, and he goes up. and then I go back to playing the top note again. That's an absurd way to play a melody. Why should the highest note and the lowest note be so much more important than all the other notes? Well, but why not? They are important, right? That's yep. where things begin and end. So there's a logic about that.
Certainly.
But it becomes funny when you actually hear people doing this in an exaggerated way.
Yes. Do you think there are prejudices against new music, and are there things you would like to see change, or is there anything you even can add to it yourself?
Well, one of the biggest prejudices is for mathematicians who do calculations and understand logical sequences very well. But whenever I question them about my music, they say, "I listen to music to not think. I think all day about, and I'm counting all day. I'm not going to count when I listen to your music." For me, this is an anti-intellectual point of view from a highly intellectual person, which is a little difficult to understand. But I think a lot of people are anti-intellectual when they listen to music. They don't even want to count, let alone think about is the key going to change? Is this the same note where the phrase started 2 seconds ago, or has it moved? Is the music moving? Is it staying the same? Those are not very complicated questions, and it's not. You don't have to be a mathematician to notice that da is not the same as da. But if you're anti-intellectual, you refuse to think about music, da and da will pass as the same thing. You didn't notice any difference because you're not trying to listen. So I think anti-intellectual listeners are losing a lot. And I can't tell people how to listen. And if you want to just listen in order not to think, as so many mathematicians do, well, that's your problem. You get your satisfaction from something else, not from music.
Certainly. You're also very, very modern in a way. You have a YouTube channel, so we are kind of colleagues.
Everybody has YouTube channel today, especially, and you have a website.
I have one, but I think in the music, yeah. There's not too much.
Maybe
it.
Not, yeah.
And I mean, I'm still also a pioneer in this area, and I think you're also very, very much ahead.
You know, one reason that people don't have their own sites is because they go to SoundCloud.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know SoundCloud?
Yes, certainly.
And it's easy to put your things up there, and then you don't have to produce things yourself, really. You just send in that's only for sound files, and you don't have to do a visual file or anything. Or you can do things on YouTube as I'm doing.
Right, you have a real video. I can see you. You explain things.
But it's a YouTube channel.
Right.
It's not
YouTube
my own
channel, and
it's not my own site.
And you also have the music played in there. It's called Illustrated Rhythm. How did you get
Illustrated
to do that?
Music?
Illustrated music. Okay.
There's 20 different videos now. All which you can find if you go to YouTube and ask for Tom Johnson Illustrated Music. Yeah, I'm very pleased with those. I've been doing them rather quickly. These 20 came in a matter of 6 months or so. And with good video people who
I think they're very, very good.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We also will put it in the show notes that hopefully my listeners will go and check it out.
I hope... Yeah, I've worked with the good video people. I have to pay because I wanted this to be very professionally done and not to be thinking about exposures and cutting myself. Somebody else has to do that. But I've found good people in Paris who I can work with and who've done good. But I think I've been going too fast. And at first, there were so many things I wanted to explain and do video about that I had a lot of ideas. But now I'm starting to think, well, it's better. I've been going too fast. I didn't want to wait till we're getting more visits and not just in the hundreds, but maybe in the thousands, like so many video YouTube sites, and learn how to do it a little better, get some more reactions, And also now it's getting harder because the things that were obvious, how I wanted to do the show, the drawing and explain the piece, I've already done. So now it's some more things that are harder to explain. I haven't even touched opera, for example. I don't think I will. Maybe it's operas are already visual. They explain themselves, or they should. And I don't think I'm going to do video about any of those pieces. But I don't know. I need to think. I need more time to. And now work more slowly.
I'm sure you will find more topics. And yeah, it sounds really great. And yeah, last night you also presented your new book, Finding Music. What can we expect there if you
well,
buy this book?
The title, was, by the way, comes from an article that I wrote for Positionen, German magazine in the late 90s, where I said, I want to find the music, not to compose it. Will die Musik finden, nicht sie komponieren. And that was a new idea for me. It means objective music, something that came from numbers that I found. 1, 2, 3 is not something I invented. And or the Pascal's triangle is not something I invented. Pascal didn't invent it either. I don't think he found that. This is a found thing, like pi and lots of other. Most mathematics is really found. Automata can be so easily deduced, usually. They're not really invented either. But it's not just mathematics. One of my favorite pieces came from physics. It's the law of the pendulum, Galileo. We just did another video about Galileo. That's
cool.
That's a nice one.
It's coming up.
It's number 20. And Pierre Berthet is the performer now. Galileo is not only the title of a piece, it's the name of an instrument, which is 4.5 meters tall. And from this bar, five pendulums swing. The longest one is 2.5 meters, and the shortest one is about less than 1 meter, I think. And the short one swings, according to the law of the pendulum, exactly twice as fast as the longest pendulum. And the pendulums in between are 2/3, 3/4, and 4/5 of the tempo. So you get these five tempos, and you can't compose anything. You have to just hit the pendulums when they come back. And if you hit them a little too early, you throw out the synchronization and you've blown the whole thing. But if you want them to be in synchronization and respect the pendulums and the law of the pendulums, you just have to keep those proportions exactly the way the pendulum swings.
Okay.
And so this is finding music in the pendulum, or in five pendulums. That, by the way, I should, we're not here to talk about other composers, but I must mention Alvin Lucier, because all of his music comes out of usually acoustical phenomena. I don't think he ever followed the pendulum law, but a lot of acoustical laws he has followed, and standing waves and different things like that. And the way strings vibrate. His music is all coming out of physics. And that's another kind of found music. But mine is more found in the numbers rather than in physical formula. But Galileo's an exception.
So about this we will read in the book,
yeah,
of Finding Music.
Yeah.
And you did it together with Gisela Gronemeyer in Raul Mörchen. It's published at Musiktexte, but I will also put that in the show notes. Last night you also did a piece, and I heard some of those pieces before, and I always love them, where you also speak. You were also speaking, and mm-hmm, also two of the musicians on stage. And how did you get to that? It's what you said, it's the describing part, but that you're also you also feel comfortable on stage doing that yourself.
Well, I don't know. I like
very
to talk.
Charming.
I like to talk. No, also because I earned my living as a music critic for 11 years with the Village Voice. So after all those years of being a music critic, I was used to talking about music. And I felt pretty good. At Yale, you know, they give you a lot of English courses. You end up controlling the language pretty well, even if you're a music major. And I liked talking. And then I didn't like anti-intellectual listeners. I wanted people to understand my music. And I explain and write the introductions and hope that people give introductions and program notes when they do concerts. But then I started wanting to write operas because in the late 60s I was going a lot to theater, and I was hearing, I wasn't a big opera fan, but I'd heard most of the standard repertoire also, but I didn't really like that too much. But as I started in the late 60s with the experimental theater scene, and I was seeing Beckett for the first time, and a lot of people were doing Gertrude Stein, the plays and operas of Gertrude Stein, which had seldom been performed, but the theater directors in New York wanted to do their versions of Gertrude Stein, because of course you can do whatever you want with these texts. But so I was starting to. And a lot of people were writing new texts, and Sam Shepard was a new voice in theater at that time. And there was Richard Schechner was starting the Performance Garage, where there were new theater ideas. And La Mama was just starting, and La Mama had lots of new pieces. So all of this energy interested me a lot, and I could see a lot of new principles happening in theater that I had never seen before. So I started thinking, but nobody's doing opera. I should do an opera. But I want to write my own text, because I don't want to try to set Gertrude Stein. That didn't make sense. Anyway, Virgil Thompson had already done that as well as I could, because he was from the period and he knew Gertrude Stein. So I had to do it in a different way. And so that was when I started writing sketches, which led to the four-note opera, which was my first opera. And so that was why I quoted a little while ago one of the arias from there. And that was a kind of humor and a kind of Tom Johnson opera, which was got me started.
Wonderful. I also would like to know, do you have a certain time management or rituals during the day, or could you advise something?
Well, I decided very young that I wouldn't take jobs accompanying modern dance classes, which was my main source of income in the late 60s, early 70s, before noon, preferably before 2 in the afternoon, because my best concentration time was in the morning. And I thought, well, I'm going to just devote my mornings to composing. Even if I don't have any ideas, at least I'll work with my tape recorder or improvise at the piano or try to sketch something and think about my own music. And that was a discipline which was important and which I still follow today pretty much. Although I'm a little more flexible about that today. Sometimes I don't feel the need to write a new piece every day.
Certainly. I can feel you. I'm also like, morning time is like my best concentration time.
Yeah, I think there are many people, but I know people who only work at 2 in the morning.
So, I know. Yeah. Everybody's different. What are you thankful for today?
Gee, that sounds like a religious question. And as a believer, I have to be thankful for my existence and the love of God and all of these things. But on a more personal, banal level, I'm really thankful that so many people appreciate my music today. That concert last night was so symbolic of the people that had disappeared from my life. I thought they disappeared, and then suddenly they're there. They still like my music, and they still want to come back to Cologne and see Tom Johnson, hear the new piece. And that's very satisfying. And I'll never be as famous as some of my contemporary composers, but I've done a lot better than most of the others. And so I can't complain. And one thing that I'm also very grateful, and this is unusual in music, I have been able to earn my living as a composer since the age of about 45. After the New York years, and I came to Europe, and Nine Bells was starting to circulate, and I started to know people in the German radio and the French radio, and I was doing Hörspiels and stuff. I found that I had more work in Europe than in the United States. And since I was had no children and no car, I didn't need a lot of money to live. And I was able to just give up criticism and accompanying modern dance and things like that, and just live with my own music. And that was very important to a relatively young age, to be able to, and never teach, I never taught. It wasn't exactly on purpose, but I only once or twice had reasonable offers for college jobs, but these always came at moments when I didn't want to be tied down because I had a tour in Europe that I was going to do, or I had some invitations to California or something, and I didn't want to be tied down to being at the theory course every Monday morning. And so I always said no. And I suppose if I'd had been offered for a really big job in a big university, I probably would have, like Morton Feldman, I would have decided to grab the money while it was there, but I never did. And it's better because I've never depended on teaching and other things too. And even if I didn't make very much money in those early years, or even now as a composer, but it's enough to live on, and I still don't have children or a car, and and my wife earns her own living, and I don't need more money than that.
Yeah. It sounds wonderful, and last night was really very, very lovely. Who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, and what inspires you?
Oh, well, my two mentors, I always say, were Morton Feldman and John Cage. And those are my idols. Feldman taught me so many things. He was really my teacher. And the only teacher I think I ever had for composition where I believed everything he said. I took everything very seriously, very literally, what he said. Elliot Carter, Udi Weiner, other people, they had interesting ideas, and it was always a little bit, maybe they're right, and maybe I should try that. But Feldman, he'd been through it, and he was doing what I wanted to do. And if he said I have to do that, I would do it. And when I was studying with him, I really didn't think he was an important composer like Cage and Elliot Carter and Stravinsky and Schoenberg. But as I tell in the end of that interview, some years later, after a transforming experience of hearing Coptic Light, this is 10 years after I'd studied with him, and the flute and orchestra, and then the long pieces. And I said, wow, Feldman, he was better than any of those others. Mm. What a chance I had to know this man.
Certainly.
That was great. Of course, when I was studying with him, it was 67 to 69. He hadn't written his best music yet. He was getting there. He'd written a lot of good music, but he hadn't written Coptic Light. He hadn't written Flute and Orchestra. He hadn't written for Philip Guston. That's wonderful to realize that finally he was better than all the others for me. But Cage was more important as a human model, because Cage, he knew what he wanted very young. And he had his master too. He never minces words about the importance of Schoenberg in his life, and the discipline of his music is the same as the discipline of Schoenberg. But then how he had the courage to try the things that nobody else wanted to try. Prepare piano, what a crazy idea. And theater music and making the music with silence, with noises and all of these things. What bravery. And you have to believe in what you're doing. And that was my model. Boy, if I could be like Cage, how can I be that strong, that sure of myself, and that ready to go against all the fashions of the day? So that was, I always tried to lead my life like Cage. Cage was also a very ethical man and a very, very clear-headed. And when I have a question should I accept this commission? Or do I want to consider working with this publisher? Do I want to accept this invitation to Oslo? When I'm not sure, I always think, what would Cage have done? Because Cage, I remember one time when he refused the invitation to Iran because there was a political problem. And other times when he refused to go with certain publishers and certain ideas. But he knew what he had to do and what was going to be the best choice. And he didn't always take the money, you know. A lot of composers just take the biggest fee and don't think too much about the principles. But he was very clear about principles, and I wanted to be like him.
Mm. That actually leads me up to my next question. What does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in the music business, and how do you keep true to yourself?
By trying to do what John Cage would have done. That's really what we were talking about.
Yes,
yeah.
We were just talking.
Yeah, he's my model as a human model. But how to listen to music, how to write my music, how to get the right sound. I have to follow Morton Feldman, because he's the one who understood that. Wow, what a great composer.
What does success mean for you?
Oh, just to be myself, what I am. I feel today that I'm as successful as I ever wanted to be. I never wanted a lot of money. I never wanted a lot of fame. I never wanted to be the president of anything or be the president of some conservatory or director of this or that ensemble. I'm successful. I'm very happy with what I am. That reminds me, when I was young, the Fornot Opera was going very well. I had control of a group that was doing this opera, and I tried to get some bookings for this opera. I thought, oh, I'll direct this opera, and if we get a lot, we can book tours, and then the next year I can write another opera, and I have my own opera company, and I'll be like Peter Maxwell Davies and organize a festival in my opera company. But that's a tough business, we didn't get very many bookings. But I decided I didn't really want that anyway. I didn't want to have to just be obligated to write another opera every year in order to get another grant, in order to pay all these singers, in order to keep going. I wanted my loft to be a little more flexible. So I didn't want that kind of money and fame either. And so I think I've... Yeah, somebody said, it's a very well-known, be careful to know what you want in life, because that's probably what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And I think I knew what I wanted in life, and that's more or less what I'm getting.
That's amazing. What drives you forward? Do you have a vision?
Yeah, I want. My only concern now is to clean up the files. I'm 80 years old, and that's, you know, average life expectancy is about that. So I don't have that many more years. And I've decided to donate all of my files to the French National Library. And I don't want them to file everything. I'm trying to get it all into boxes the way I want, so that things are classed in the way they should be, and not just leave these things to functionaries who probably don't know the music and won't get it right anyway. And so I'm trying to put together the sketches that go with the particular pieces that they belong with, and the pieces that are related to one another go with the sketches related to tile work, or with self-similar melodies, or with self-replicating melodies, and try to classify these things. And then, now that I've got their files pretty well organized, the things that are on paper, and more or less all of the mediocre pieces and the student pieces have been completely destroyed.
Really?
Yeah. Oy. The ones, you know, I say in somewhere that you shouldn't leave all of this evaluation to the musicologists. The composers and writers should take a little responsibility themselves for throwing out the real bad pieces. But now, there's still a lot of things unexplained, so that's one reason why I started the illustrated music videos. So I want to try to do videos and drawings. A lot of times in the 80s and 90s, I wasn't doing drawings at all. And a lot of times a drawing that shows the form of a piece in a symbolic, numerical way adds a lot to the understanding of a piece. And it's nice to, sometimes I do that with the illustrated music video, and it explains things a lot better. So that in this way, when people come to the file of Galileo, and they can see the video and the sketches for this, and the early visions, photos of the early visions, and of how the instrument was before I had a good instrument, and so forth. It's the piece is really finished with the complete file, and just the score was not really the finished piece.
Well, we already are at the last question. And my last question is, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Be yourself. Let the music do what it wants to do. That's what this, I should have thought of that first. But that means be yourself also. But no, it means it's a little different. But that's what Feldman always told me. And that's what he always did. Let the music do what it wants to do. And he would spend hours at the piano listening to three chords and trying to figure out if there was another chord that went with them or not, and if the F sharp should be in the high octave or the low octave, and if maybe he should add a G. You know, he wasn't sure. He listened to it again. Let me write it again. And I tell the story about the six, seven chords that I wrote for him, and how he played it over and over at the piano because he knew that I hadn't really listened. But he wanted to listen, show me how to listen. Mm-hmm. And so this is it. But his main question as he listened is, what is this music wanting to do? Let it do what it wants to do. Forget what I want it to do. Forget all of my own ambitions for this piece, my own, and what the performers are going to want and what the audience is going to want. What does the music want? I think that's a very good question for any composer who wants to be himself or herself and just do something honest, something different from everybody else. Yeah. End of sermon.
Yeah. Well, Tom, thank you so much for taking your time and being here with me, and I wish you all the luck with whatever you will still do, and
great.
Enjoy your time in Cologne.
Yeah.
I hope that this interview was inspiring for you. And if you want, you can write me your ideas or suggestions through Facebook or through email. I'm looking forward to hear from you. Thank you that you listened to my podcast today. And I really hope that you liked it and that it inspired you. I would be very happy if you could suggest this podcast to your friends and colleagues. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.